C. Set the agenda. 3. Most important, make sure you are taking the right job. Section 3. Get results. Navigate the challenges of the role. The 5 hidden hazards at the top. Not just any team, your team. Dancing with the Titans, the board. Chapter 9. The 5 hidden hazards at the top. You're off to great places. Today is your day. Your mountain is waiting, so get on your way. Dr. Seuss, Oh, the Places You'll Go. Madeline Bell was sitting in her office on the 12th floor of the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, CHOP, on a bright June day in 2015 when she got the call. The position of CEO was hers. Madeline was elated. 32 years of devoted work had culminated in her being selected to lead one of the world's most renowned pediatric hospitals, saving children's lives and shaping standards of pediatric care globally. She felt a rush of emotions, probably akin to what world-class athletes feel as they step onto the track at the Olympic Games. You've spent your whole life preparing for this. There's joy and fear, doubt and hope, all wrapped together, she recalls. It would be a breathtaking moment for anyone. For Madeline, the first female and the first nurse to rise to the top of CHOP in its 160-year history, it was a landmark achievement. 6 weeks later, Madeline stepped into the role, and like most new CEOs, she instantly found herself at the epicenter of a torrent of issues, urgent queries, and requests. Madeline's CFO and general counsel quickly brought her up to speed on aspects of her job that were completely off her radar. For example, she was now the hospital's representative as a major shareholder of Spark Therapeutics, a $2 billion a year gene therapy company that had been spun off from CHOP. Who knew? Requests for her presence inside and outside of the organization were pouring in. After every appearance she made, a line of people formed to grab a few moments of her attention. She quickly saw her role with new eyes. Before, it was actually easy. I had one boss. I had thought CEOs don't have a boss. Now, instead of one boss, I have thousands of bosses. All 14,000 employees, this whole community, the donors, the board members, everybody who cares about us. In my first year, I woke up in the middle of the night and felt literally a wave of anxiety wash over me. They're all depending on me to deliver. What if something big goes wrong? I felt grave responsibility on my shoulders. An MRI able to track the emotions of any new CEO's brain would reveal a pattern of thoughts and reactions similar to Madeline's. The initial elated, wow, I did it, could it really be me? Careens to the anxious, oh boy, what did I walk into? And bottoms out with the grave, it's all on me now. Am I ready? What if I fail? Madeline spoke for many when she told us the CEO role was so much weightier than I expected in terms of eyes on you as the leader. There really are very few people who understand it. It's a lonely place. Madeline had become a celebrity overnight. Wherever she went, she was now on stage. Every meeting that I'm in, I'm under the microscope, she says. They are thinking, what's her reaction? What's her body language? What's she saying? When I wake up in the morning, I look at my calendar. I'm going to the audit committee meeting of our board, where I have an important sticky topic. Then I'm going to be running to kick off a big fundraising event and so on. It's just being on, and in every different place, how do I want to show up? In our experience, a typical CEO takes roughly 2 years to feel comfortable in the role. Guess how long it takes for a typical board to fire a CEO who has demonstrated fatal flaws? Roughly 2 years. There's not a lot of time to prove yourself. The big question on every new CEO's mind and on the minds of anyone in a new role. What is it that I don't know that can kill me? To answer that question, we dove deep into 70 situations where CEOs were fired so we could understand the root causes. We also closely analyzed common patterns of mistakes made by first-time CEOs. We interviewed investors, board members, team members, and others to analyze the reasons, circumstances, and outcomes. The third section of this book is dedicated to helping leaders avoid the biggest mistakes first-time CEOs make. Many of these insights are applicable for anyone entering a new role. Here's what many first-time CEOs understand only in the rearview mirror. Their new role isn't just a more difficult, supersized version of leadership positions they've held in the past. It is a completely different job, requiring shifts in their habits, assumptions, attention, and time, new filters, new relationships, and more. When we analyzed patterns of mistakes among first-time CEOs, we found that over 40% of them struggled to adapt their leadership style to the unique contours of their new position quickly enough. If you have been with us for the last 8 chapters of this book, you are already coming into the CEO role better prepared than most. This chapter is dedicated to uncovering and arming you to navigate the 5 most common hazards that first-time CEOs, and in many cases any senior leader, must navigate in order to adapt to the needs of the new role. The next chapter then dives into the single most common mistake of new CEOs, failure to quickly get your team in place. And chapter 11 closes out this section by parting the veil on the number one concern for most new CEOs, navigating the new world of the board of directors. Applying the lessons in this section can help prevent avoidable should-have-known mistakes, leaving more of your energy to leading the company to success and to handling the inevitable surprises that come your way. Even more important, knowing what you should and should not worry about can free your mind to play to win. To paraphrase Groucho Marx, learn from the mistakes of others, or you may not be in the job long enough to make them all yourself. Hazard number 1. The ghouls in the supply closet. You've taken the helm. More than anything, you want to prove yourself worthy of the job. You've heard about the vision thing and can't wait to wow the board and the team with your inspiring vision for the future. Or maybe you pride yourself on getting things done and are raring to show how quickly you can knock off items on the endless list of priorities. Whatever your style, you are hungry to start strong out of the gate. Therefore, our first piece of advice may be the hardest to heed. Stop. Pause. Before you paint a picture of the bright future, and even before you go knocking off the tempting low-hanging fruit, take a very close look at what you have walked into. Whether you've been promoted into the role or brought in from the outside, you are moving into a new, unfamiliar house, and before you start your renovation projects, you would do well to acquaint yourself with what you have inherited to begin with. Your first task: to reenact that harrowing scene you find in every horror film, the one where the movie's hero walks through the house, opening doors and pulling back curtains, trying to find and contain the ghoul before the ghoul stabs her in the back. No matter how well you've been briefed by the board, they probably failed to tell you about the serial killer in the shower. Chances are that they have no idea he's there. The first order of business is to search every dark corner, decide what's a genuine threat versus just a creepy but harmless shadow, and then decide how to best deal with it. Take Paul, who stepped in to run our client's recycling company. He had been told the company had a groundbreaking new technology for turning dirty plastic into clean, reusable plastic. It sounded great, until Paul showed up for duty and discovered his first ghoul. The product was not performing in the field as well as it was supposed to, As a result, the sales cycles lagged and they ran out of cash. Paul didn't get fired, but he had to leave the company because they could no longer afford to pay him. Not every ghoul is survivable, but the earlier you find them, the better your chances of survival are. What kinds of threats might you find? Here are some common examples. A critical gap between the board's expectations and the reality inside the business. A hidden financial or operational bomb that's now in your lap, e.g. loss of a major customer, cost overruns on a large project, IT implementation problems. A sacred cow or cultural blind spot that has the potential to stymie exactly the changes needed to grow the business. Signs coming from a level or two down that one of your critical people isn't up to his or her job or is on the way out. The best way to conquer the ghouls? Let the light in. Lay out the ghouls and goblins in front of your board, team, and others to show, this is where we are, this is what we're up against, here's how we're going to fix it. The clock is ticking. Anything you bring to light in the first 6 months in the role will be viewed as part of what you walked into, setting the baseline. After that, it's your problem. If you fail to parade the ghouls early, you'll own them forever. Use what you have learned to set realistic expectations and develop well-informed plans for delivering on those expectations. As hard as it is to start your brand new CEO role with a bit of sobering news, it beats failing on expectations that were never realistic in the first place. When Scott Clawson arrived to take the helm at Culligan, a water treatment company that had been purchased by a private equity firm, he pulled up the financial floorboards and found that the business was behind plan. When prior management sold the company to investors, they predicted that the company would produce $60 million EBITDA. As I dug into the details, the number was much closer to $45 million. I flew to New York for a few very tough conversations with my board. Ultimately, they supported me. Scott was fortunate that this was his second CEO position with these investors. He had just delivered nearly fourfold returns on another company he had run for the same private equity firm. So even when there was no growth the first year, his board stood by him. We get it. We trust you. Let's go. Over the next 3 years, Scott grew EBITDA by about $10 million a year, culminating in a successful sale and a remarkable turnaround of a brand that was once a household name. Your first step as you pause in the new job, hear your major stakeholders out. This is true whether you are the CEO, a middle manager, or an individual contributor. We'll talk in detail in Chapter 11 about how to build an effective partnership with the board to develop a clear picture of how they view your business now, their needs, and their expectations for the future. Once you understand where they sit, you've got the much harder job of gathering the data to develop your own point of view. It's time for your listening tour. Neil Fiske, CEO of Billabong, whom you first met in Chapter 3, kicked off the early weeks of his CEO tenure by spending an hour daily interviewing his senior team and the managers at least two levels down. The feedback from these conversations produced, in his words, a rich roadmap of issues that need to be addressed and questions to be confronted. Go even farther. Walk the floors. Visit the field offices. Ask people what they think is working and what isn't, and go outside the organization to get a broader perspective on your industry. Interview outsiders and the most important experts of all, the customers. You would not believe the stuff I heard. Mary Berner, the CEO of Cumulus Media, told us of the listening tours she conducted as the CEO of Reader's Digest between 2007 and 2011. Mary regularly visited the company's many field offices scattered across 50 countries and randomly sat down with groups of 10 employees from the mailroom on up for off-the-record conversations. She asked them what they would do in her shoes. She asked for their thoughts on what would help the company get even better. She took notes. In this way, she heard about problems ranging from the absurd. There was a serious goose poop issue on our main campus's lawn, to the serious. We found a case of expense fraud. Even if you're lucky enough to inherit a basically stable business, PG-level thrills, not an R-rated slasher, you will often hear conflicting views from the board, corporate staff, line employees, and customers. All of that helps you build a realistic baseline on the business, set goals grounded in reality, and identify risks you have to attend to. You may not be able to banish every ghoul, but understanding even the intractable issues protects you from surprises, giving you space to develop workarounds while you still have the luxury of a clean slate. Get skeletons out of the closet and into the light so that you can start the process of getting everyone excited about the inspirational new script, yours. Your Year One Checklist. Assess the shape of the business and get skeletons out of the closet. Set vision and strategy. Set the baseline and new expectations for plans, budgets, and projections with your board and the market if applicable. Score a couple of early wins. Assess and upgrade the team as required. Hazard number two, entering warp speed. Emails, keynote opportunities, media requests, meetings, fundraisers, galas, small decisions, big decisions, new information, responsibilities. Oh my! A simple walk to the bathroom is now an impromptu meet and greet and a major commitment of time. Kevin Cox, the CHRO of American Express, who sits on several boards and is often sought after for leadership advice, likens the first CEO role to being a new quarterback. The game looks awfully fast to a rookie quarterback. Good coaches attempt to simplify the game to slow it down. Just the same, the game looks fast to a new CEO. They are instantly inundated. They just need to slow the game down enough to play it well. This is very important. You only get so many chances, and then you get benched. While this time crunch is especially acute for CEOs, any leader who makes the transition to leading a larger organization will experience some degree of it. We asked CEOs how their focus shifted when they reached the top. For non-CEO executives outside of sales, an average of 80% of their time was focused internally. For CEOs, that dropped to 55%. The time they spent externally more than doubled from 20 to 45%. A vast multitude of new stakeholders requires CEO attention, on the board, with shareholders, regulators, government, customers, partners, reaching out to the industry, the media, and the broader world. In other words, you're going to have to take on the most challenging job of your life, running an enterprise, in significantly less time than you devoted to running the business in previous positions. Can you imagine doing your current job in only two-thirds of the time? How do you make that seemingly impossible math work? How do you stretch time? The first step isn't to change what you focus your attention on, but when. Time is moving faster, so look forward. Set coordinates in the future so that warp drive will take you to your desired destination. CEOs who shift their time horizon farther out are more successful at adapting their organizations to change. While non-CEO executives typically spend almost 80% of their time focused on issues affecting the next 12 months, CEOs spend over 40% of their attention focused more than a year into the future. This practice instantly creates a filter for all those incoming demands on their time. 1 or 2 years from now, is this going to matter? Such filters are key to managing the crushing cognitive load of this new role. The second important filter is your administrative assistant. A CEO produces results by deploying people, time, and capital. Your assistant steers a key lever, your time. When Madeline Bell became CEO, she brought her assistant with her. The assistant had competently supported Madeline while she was the COO. Madeline welcomed this small but important island of stability amidst all the turmoil of a new role. Unfortunately, as Madeline's role and priorities shifted dramatically, her assistant kept managing her calendar in the same way she had for years, prioritizing calendar time for one-on-ones with internal people. She treated requests from the board and other external constituents as a distraction. Madeline sat her down to tell her, "As a CEO, I need to spend time differently than I have previously. The board and external constituents are now my priority, and many of the people who used to get a lot of access now need to go to my COO instead." Flexing a strong reliability muscle, Madeline coached her assistant to train everyone else how to interact with her. As COO, she had had time, for example, to read an entire merger agreement and offer her thoughts to the general counsel. Now she needed bullet points. "I've had to create a system of people who are filtering and packaging for me in a way that I never had before," she says. When something comes in that's not ready, her assistant punts it back. Everything needs to come in summarized. For you to step up to the new responsibilities of a more senior role, you often need to train others around you how to work with you. One of the CEOs had his assistant send out a structured format for his one-on-one meetings with direct reports. Their agenda can cover any or all of 6 prescribed priority areas, including progress on key initiatives, issues of material consequence, and professional satisfaction. 2 business days before meetings, his directs are required to submit a bulleted outline of their agenda. Does this level of structure feel overly exacting and pedantic? A few may chafe at the new rules, but many will appreciate clarity about how to work with you effectively. Even if you are at the helm of a $20 million company, and 2 days advance preparation seems like a ridiculous dream, ask yourself what steps you can be taking to allocate most of your time and attention to the top priorities. Something as simple as delegating control of your calendar to an assistant can free up a lot of time and energy, but could also be hard to do, especially for an entrepreneur. Rob Wenger, CEO of a quickly growing small software company, told us, "Empowering an assistant can be hard when you've been used to doing everything yourself, but life-changing. Having support has changed my life. My days are efficient and my time is spent linked to my goals instead of reacting to what comes at me." After coaching and interviewing dozens of CEOs on surviving business at the speed of sound, we've distilled a few more tactics for mastering warp speed. Fit to size. Whether your default time window for a meeting is 15 minutes or 30, actively manage your calendar to ensure that you allocate appropriate time and attention depending on the level of priority and complexity of an issue. Make a disciplined habit of getting in, getting to the point, and getting out of meetings and conversations. Kim worked with a CEO who never spent more than 15 minutes on a phone call with her, unless an important issue came up that was too complex and consequential to handle in 15 minutes. Then he called her at 6 a.m. from California for a thorough, unhurried conversation. 6 in the morning, it turned out, was when he took his dog on her daily walk. It was the time he preserved for decisions and conversations that required more space and consideration. The calendar reality check. We've shocked many CEOs by leading them and their assistants through calendar reviews. These are leaders who know their priorities. They believe they're aggressively focused on their priorities, and they are confident that they know where they spend their time. Their calendars often tell a very different story. We analyze every appointment and map exactly which stakeholders and what priorities are getting the most and least time and attention. The results of these reviews are always eye-opening. We recently had one CEO, for example, tell us her first priority that year had been to expand into China. That top priority turned out to be receiving 3% of her time. So it wasn't surprising that the company was still, literally, thousands of miles from its goal. Calendar reviews are a revealing exercise, helpful at any stage to make sure that your time, attention, and actions are aligned with your stated priorities. First, ask yourself, if anything were possible, how would you allocate your time in line with your priorities? Then ask your assistant to compare your goals to how you actually spend your time. We recommend you conduct this exercise twice in your first year and annually thereafter with four questions in mind. 1. How well does your time allocation represent your business and life priorities? 2. How well does your time allocation represent your relationship priorities? 3. How much time are you spending on short versus long-term issues? 4. How much time are you spending internally versus externally? The polite no. When Andy Silvernail became the CEO of IDEX Corporation, a wise mentor in his 70s took him to a congratulatory lunch. "I've seen this movie a few times before, so here's my advice, take it or leave it," he told Andy. The CEO role is a different beast. It is demanding and it is seductive. There's just two things you need to understand to make it work. 1, nothing's more important than your team. But 2, you need to know when you need to appear and when you don't, he said. Once you get appointed CEO, your popularity index soars in an instant. You have new access to elite corners of business and society. You get gilded invitations to enticing events, invitations to sit on a variety of boards, requests to speak at conferences. Just yesterday, you were in the back row taking notes as other industry CEOs shared their wisdom. So when you are invited to be one of them, it is easy to be seduced. Thanks to his mentor, Andy learned quicker than most to relentlessly filter these requests with the choosy eye of a veteran rather than the hungry enthusiasm of a rookie. What seemed tantalizingly out of reach just yesterday might well be a distraction you can no longer afford. Too many new CEOs, faced with their newfound popularity, set their bar for yes far too low. We often coach first-time CEOs to shift perspectives from new kid on the block to imagine they already are a leading CEO in the industry before deciding what they say yes or no to. This enables them to redirect precious time and energy from subpar engagements to delivering results that would indeed make them into a leading CEO. Before you get flooded and seduced, be clear about your goals. What do you really want? To advance your business? To learn from the best? To elevate your status? One new CEO was recently reprimanded by his board for jumping into the company jet to visit the White House in his first months on the job. The company was bleeding cash in the midst of a tough turnaround, and the CEO was seen as advancing his own agenda rather than helping the business by accepting the high-profile invitation. Everyone's situation and filter will be slightly different, but in the first year, you're in safe territory if you only accept invitations that move specific goals forward or make you a better CEO. Andy Silvernail uses those criteria, but with an additional personal filter. He chooses the opportunities that interfere the least with his family time. Hazard 3, amplification and the permanent spotlight. As CEO, everything you do is amplified. Every pat on the back, every email, every compliment. You don't just casually stop by somebody's desk anymore. They think it is a signal of how they're doing, when in fact, you had to go to the bathroom. Your kid's sick and you didn't go to their meeting, and they think that that means that you hate their idea. Everything is viewed through the role of you as CEO. That reflection is from Doug Shipman, President and CEO of the Woodruff Arts Center. When you ask anyone about the most surprising shocks of becoming a boss, you'll inevitably hear some version of it. We call this phenomenon amplification. You are now the face of your company, the bellwether of its future, the embodiment of its values. Your smallest motion ripples across the organization. You are constantly under a spotlight as people scrutinize every twitch of your eyebrow, the words you choose, the way you spend your time. They're not just curious, they're on the hunt for clues to direct their own behavior. The bottom line is, the way people relate to you as the boss, even people who were just yesterday your peers, is completely and utterly different. Understand this, adapt your leadership style accordingly, and amplification stops being a hazard. In fact, it becomes one of the most potent tools in your new kit. At the most basic level, fine-tune your body language. If the entire organization is cueing off your mood, you need to radiate positivity or at least have a good poker face. Jim Harrison, the CEO of Party City, has embraced what he calls the smile rule for 25 years. As a leadership team, we can argue, debate, whatever, but when we leave here, we all smile, he says. He's been smiling ever since an employee told him that his default expression, a scowl, was terrifying every employee he crossed paths with, and so he shifted to a smile. When I'm at a facility, I walk around, say hello, ask how they're doing, so they know I'm not a bad guy and things are going well, he says. While the smile rule may not work in all cultures and contexts, employ the body language that conveys confidence and a positive outlook to your organization. The days are over when you can lose your temper and unconsciously wear your emotions on your sleeve. As a CEO, transmit negative emotions with care and precision to achieve a desired outcome, not because you are at the mercy of your emotions. Know your triggers and work to manage them. As Larry Pryor, CEO of technology services company CSRA, likes to say, as a CEO, you are too senior to lose your temper not on purpose. One executive we've been advising puts his hand in his pocket during difficult conversations so that he can pinch himself. A sharp physical reminder to stay calm when I'm seeing something coming that I know will upset me. CEO amplification runs deeper than mood swings. People seize upon everything you say and do as a potential call to action. When Tom Monahan, the first non-founder CEO of business information company CEB, spent a day in the company's Boston offices, he shared a nostalgic moment with one of his team members. I told him that I grew up in Boston, and I could see my whole life from this office window, he told us. My high school, the train I took to school, my dad's office, I could see it all from this vantage point. Years later, CEB was consolidating its office footprint. Tom was surprised that Boston was nowhere on the list of potential closures. He learned that everyone had assumed the current location of the Boston office was untouchable because it had a special place in Tom's heart. Tom's brief moment of nostalgia, shared years earlier, now echoed back to him as a rationale for a costly decision that was not his intention. How many other things are out there like this, he wondered. Once you recognize the incredible power of amplification, look for opportunities to use it to its greatest positive effect. Thomson Reuters CEO Jim Smith, for example, told us about a conference call he had the day after Brexit, the United Kingdom's vote to withdraw from the European Union. Harvard economist and former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers had called it the single worst thing to happen to Europe since World War II. Jim asked the folks from his London office, "How's it feeling there today?" Their response, "Like ground zero." It was a casual conversation before the real business of the meeting, but a thought flashed through Jim's mind. It's my job to lead us through this. Instead of echoing their low spirits, he took a positive tone. Let's remember, folks, in any disruption, there's always opportunity. He talked about the company's responsibility to help customers find those opportunities. We stay focused on the customers. Let's stay focused on what we can control and do our best at that, he said. With a few simple lines, he gave his employees the comforting knowledge that despite upheaval, their power was real and important, reassurance that would impact their behavior in the hours, days, and weeks that followed. Your new reality is this. Every move matters. Every gesture is profound. Your words are no longer musings, banter, input, or casual thoughts. They are declarations with the power to shape the future. Use them to create the future you want for your business. Hazard number four. It's a smartphone, not a calculator. Maybe you've seen that old Seinfeld episode where Jerry loses his head because his father will only use his new wizard organizer as a calculator. Jerry, it does other things. That phenomenon is not so different when an executive moves into the CEO role, but it's far more costly. In our review of 70 CEO firings, a fifth of the CEOs were fired because they didn't use the full set of business levers available to them, the CEO-specific means of influencing outcomes. Many first-time CEOs come up via a specific professional track, like finance or marketing. Suddenly, these new CEOs are responsible for the full enterprise, including the functions they have never run. CEOs have at their disposal levers of value creation that are unique and often unfamiliar. First and foremost, the CEO's role is setting the strategy and vision for the enterprise. Prior to being CEO, the focus was likely on executing a strategy in a single function or business segment. Now, as CEO, job number one is to set a strategic direction for the company grounded in understanding of internal and external conditions and a full view of the entire business. An investment firm recently engaged us to help them understand why a CEO of one of their retail businesses was severely underperforming and what to do about it. Sandy had been a fantastic general manager, squeezing impressive growth out of her handful of locations. Her wheelhouse was the in-store experience, fine-tuning product and merchandising, promotions, and staffing to get customers to buy. When she became CEO, her focus never shifted from inside the stores. Meanwhile, the real threats were outside. A tightening credit market made it harder for the company to get required financing. Several downward industry trends created perfect storm conditions, leading to slower growth. She was struggling because she led exclusively through the filter of her prior expertise. She never stepped back to set the course for the business. The company needed a strong CEO, not a great general manager. We see some CEOs stumble because they fall back on their historical strengths. The former CFO who over-indexes on cost reduction in a business that desperately needs to grow. The operational whiz who makes incremental productivity gains only to lose hundreds of millions on foreign exchange rates. The sales leader who expands the customer base but not the production capacity and quickly hits a wall. Beware of a hammer perpetually seeing nails. As a CEO now, you need to work from the satellite view to rise above individual functions to see the full enterprise, spotting choke points and directing resources to where they can have the most impact. So what exactly are the new levers available to a CEO? Here are three that new CEOs often don't sufficiently attend to. Lever 1, culture shaping. In our advisory work, we are often struck by the contrast between first-time CEOs and the CEOs who are ready to pass the baton after a successful tenure. Many of the retiring CEOs reflect in hindsight that cultural change was by far the hardest and yet the most impactful change they had instilled in the business. They frequently wish they had placed more attention on culture earlier. Even as they prepare to pass the reins, many of them are eager to reinforce the culture and values that they hope will transcend their tenure in the business. Ironically, when we advise recently appointed CEOs, culture is often something they readily agree is important, but often don't act on early enough because there are more pressing, harder business priorities at hand. Neglecting the company culture is akin to training for a marathon in a city with dangerously elevated air pollution and ignoring the warnings because you've got to keep up with your training regimen. You may train yourself into your grave. On the other hand, CEOs who make culture a priority early often see exponential returns on their efforts. Ian Reid was appointed CEO of Pfizer in 2010, when the company was in dire straits. He inherited a corrosive political culture devoid of trust and innovation, a cliff of expiring patents on the most profitable medicines, and a stock trading around $15 per share, down from $24 in 2006. A lot of hard business issues needed attention. Ian's first order of business? In his very first days as the CEO, Ian put forward cultural imperatives that he believed were foundational to turning around performance. Ian and his CHRO, Chuck Hill, spared no effort to improve the culture and to back it up with action. Today, terms like straight talk and dare to try are increasingly the way of life at Pfizer. Ian and Chuck viewed every interaction and major decision as an opportunity to reinforce the desired culture. In 2014, Pfizer sought to buy AstraZeneca for $118 billion, a very high-profile deal. When AstraZeneca's board demanded a 10% higher price for the company, Ian decided to walk away. Ian held a global company-wide town hall the next morning. He candidly acknowledged his disappointment that the deal didn't happen and seized the opportunity to reinforce the cultural message. To be a leading pharmaceutical company, we have to dare to try. We have to take risks. This deal was my dare to try move. It didn't work out, but it was the right deal to pursue initially, and the right deal to walk away from when the price got too high. You've seen me try and fail and live to fight another day. I encourage you each to take risks for the sake of making us better. Dare to try. Ian's clarity of message and his role modeling have paid off. The company is much healthier today than it was 7 years ago when Ian took the helm. The stock price has more than doubled, and company culture has turned from a source of consternation into a source of pride. Tomes have been written about corporate culture, and we won't repeat them here. Just remember, whether you intend to focus on your company culture or not, much like air, it will have an ever-present impact on your results. You'll want to be intentional about it. For a busy and maybe even slightly overwhelmed leader new to a role, we offer three ways to shape the cultural imprint you leave on the organization. 1. How consistently you articulate and model the behaviors you seek. 2. Where you put your time and attention. 3. Whom you hire, fire, and promote. If you do nothing else, ask yourself once a year what your aspirational intent as CEO is and how well you translate this intent into these three sets of actions. Lever 2. Financial strategy. By the time you become CEO, chances are that you're an expert at operating a business. As a division president or a general manager, you have been laser-focused on driving the bottom line. As CEO, you've got to use both the balance sheet and the P&L to create shareholder value. How are you making capital allocation decisions? How are you managing cash flow, optimizing taxes, investing capital, scouting potential acquisitions? 5 years ago, Elena introduced Seth Siegel to the board of the company that hired him for his first CEO job, Woodbury Products. Near the top of his list of a new CEO's most important to-dos is this: carve out dedicated time with the CFO so that he or she can walk you through the P&L, balance sheet, and cash flow. Get answers to questions such as, how much control exists over the largest expense line items? What is the cash conversion cycle and the projected CapEx? What are the policies on such key items as revenue recognition and depreciation? What are our terms with key lenders? If finance isn't your strength, you've got to find someone who can help you learn. When Steve Kaufman was promoted from a division president to CEO of Arrow Electronics, he was totally unprepared for the Wall Street part of it. A typical operator, he knew the P&L statement well. But I didn't really understand the financial engineering of the balance sheet or how to deal with analysts and investors. Steve partnered with the chairman at the time to get a crash course on financial engineering and investor relations. Lever 3. Corporate diplomacy. A CEO's satellite view naturally extends your area of influence beyond the walls of your company. Your company's success is impacted by the ecosystem you inhabit and your role in this ecosystem. No matter whether you are a flagship global company shaping the industry, a disruptive new entrant, or a small local player looking to fly under the radar, ignore at your peril the industry and broader geopolitical, regulatory, and macroeconomic dynamics. To set the right course and steer the business, a CEO must understand and often attempt to influence the terrain and context the company operates in. Building alliances, shaping PR, and interfacing with government at the local, industry, country, and at times even the global level, these are all tools for amassing the influence required to fully set the agenda as CEO. On September 15, 2001, Leo Mullen, the CEO of Delta Airlines, was watching from his office window as Delta's first plane took off following the terrorist attacks of September 11th. But even as the plane rose safely into the air, Leo knew that his company and the whole industry was in deep trouble. In the aftermath of the horrifying events, people were simply not flying. Ticket sales and therefore revenue dried up. In an industry with enormous fixed costs, this amounted to a rapid downward spiral. Delta, even with the strongest balance sheet in the industry, had but a few short months' worth of cash to cover its huge impending operating losses. Leo recalls waking at 5 a.m. the next morning, looking in the mirror and saying to himself, "I've got to handle this. It's on me." He realized Delta could not do this alone, given the magnitude of the problem. All the other major carriers were in the same or worse positions. In the urgency of the moment, it was never more apparent that the responsibility of CEOs goes beyond the walls of the company or personal interests. By 10 a.m., Leo was on the phone with CEOs of other airlines. Within a week, he was testifying on behalf of the airline industry in the packed Senate and House chambers, steering key players in the industry and government toward a painful but necessary solution. This fast action led to the approval of a $15 billion governmental support package that saved the industry. These were extraordinary measures in extraordinary times. Whether confronting a national crisis at the helm of a Fortune 500 company or negotiating with local authorities over medical reimbursement or real estate permits, a CEO must be ready to fulfill the role of the company's chief ambassador to the outside world. Recalibrate your power. The CEO role is new and different from anything you've done before, and your historical sources of power aren't necessarily going to apply. What got you here? Knowing the business closely? Being the smartest one in the room? Owning key customer relationships? Being loved by the CEO? Every CEO needs to candidly assess her capabilities and sources of power that have helped her to date, then deliberately recalibrate her tools, time, attention, and team, to ensure the appropriate focus in her new role as CEO. Every company is different, every CEO position is different, but some common patterns apply. Knowledge and insight. The knowledge that gives a CEO power is a broad understanding of the business, not specialized knowledge of a function or business segment. Access to information. The information that gives a CEO power is predominantly interpreting big picture patterns from outside the company and their implications on the business, rather than detailed information from inside the business. Formal and informal network. CEOs focus on building networks outside the company and recalibrate their views on their pre-existing internal network. Loyalty. Followership and loyalty of your team are now much more important than the loyalty of your boss. Positional authority. The best CEOs use positional authority sparingly. Hazard number 5. The C-suite is a psychological thunderdome. The ghouls, the time warp, the spotlight, the explosive pressure. We've covered some intense territory so far, and it all comes together to create the perfect conditions for hazard number 5. Every day as a CEO can be a psychological maelstrom. Every day you are tested, stakes are high. Fates and fortunes of hundreds or thousands of employees and customers are affected by your daily decisions. You often feel you are walking on a knife's edge between success and failure. In this role of seemingly ultimate authority and power, a lot is still outside of your control. The one thing utterly within your control is showing up to this high-stakes obstacle course in your absolute best condition to perform and win. In some CEOs, we've seen the heady mix of power and celebrity lead to an inflated ego and entitled behavior. Caught up in the pressure and responsibility of the role, they risk losing sight of civility and even ethics. We were recently coaching a leader who was at the top of his company's shortlist of CEO candidates, but feeling hesitant about stepping up because he had seen close up how power can corrupt. "I have seen so much crazy," he told us. "I don't want to get drunk and throw a chair through a plate glass mirror or sleep with my assistant like my last CEO, and I definitely don't want to go to jail like the guy 3 CEOs ago. Another CEO told us that he was divorced because he'd neglected his marriage. Not so much because he was buried in the business, but because he was jumping into the company jet to be at every high-cachet event, no matter how many time zones it removed him from his wife. And finally, the most persistent and pervasive psychological challenge of all, loneliness. Wary of the stereotypical lonely-at-the-top notion when we interviewed CEOs for the book, we never asked them if they were lonely. And yet, time and again, they brought it up, unprompted, eager to help prepare others for the weighty isolation of the role. Within the walls of the company, you are a cohort of one. People who were your peers just yesterday are now treating you with deference, or worse, are distant and aloof because you got the job they wanted. You've got a lot of people depending on you, and nobody with whom you can be completely candid and unfiltered. As Jim Smith of Thomson Reuters put it, at times it can feel like everybody's working you for something. They may be positioning for more investment in their business unit. They may be trying to manage down my expectations. Whatever it is, once you are CEO, nothing is just a conversation. You can thrive even in this pressure cooker, but self-regulation has never been as important or as hard to maintain. Here are some proven approaches from successful CEOs. 1. Create winning routines. Major League Baseball players are famous for their elaborate superstitions. Turk Wendell famously pitched without socks and while chewing black licorice, brushing his teeth every inning without fail. Braves player Elliot Johnson chews grape gum for defense and watermelon for hitting. Olympic swimmer Michael Phelps has a routine circumscribing every move he makes in the 2 hours before any major event. More than superstitions, these are rituals that world-class athletes use to get their mind ready for peak performance, to silence all the noise and distraction of an arena and their life beyond it, and focus on the demands of their sport. CEOs are no different. They need disciplined rituals and routines that keep them consistent and grounded and that simplify life. Such tools enable them to hit a mental reset button after a bad customer meeting and walk into a board meeting a minute later, fresh and ready to engage. They also serve as grounding to stave off daily anxiety and get a good night's sleep. Just like athletes, a CEO benefits from consistent routines that reliably put her in peak condition. Krista Ensley, former CEO of Abilla Software Company, likes self-talk, constantly reminding herself, I don't have a liver in my office in a cooler. This isn't life and death here. Wendy Kopp, the founder of Teach for America, goes running every single morning. As Matt Kramer, her successor as CEO there, told us, no matter how tired she is, no matter the time, she gets up. If it has to be 4 in the morning, then it's 4 in the morning. That is her time for setting things aside and thinking about the world. One CEO we work with knew there was one place he could go if he needed some quiet time, uninterrupted by people constantly asking him questions. The dentist. Whatever winning routines work best for you, build them now. Turn them into daily habits so that when you need them most, they are there to serve you. 2. Protect against identity theft. Thanks to 20 minutes in a Singaporean cab with legendary McKinsey alum Ted Hall, Dom Barton, the managing partner, i.e. CEO of McKinsey, learned he had been the victim of identity theft. It was 7:30 a.m., and the two men were to connect in the hotel lobby to head to an 8 a.m. meeting with the finance minister of Singapore. When Ted showed up, Dom's jaw dropped. Ted Hall is a big, intense guy, he recalls, and he's wearing this big red Hawaiian shirt. Dom immediately pleaded with him to go change. You can't wear that to a meeting with the finance minister. Ted was completely unmoved. Dom had a choice, this shirt or no shirt at all. Finally, they got into the cab and Dom wanted to prep. He asked Ted for the document he was supposed to bring. Ted shrugged. What document? Dom started to lay into him, but Ted cut him off. Dom, if I had a document, I'd rip it up and throw it out the door, he said. Shocked, Dom muttered, maybe we should cancel this meeting. You're tired. I think you have jet lag. Ted cut him off. Let me ask you a rhetorical question. Are you an interesting person? The answer is no, you're not. In fact, I think you are the most boring person I have ever met. I know you had hobbies when you joined the firm, but we've sucked it all out of you. That's a problem. I'm a musician. I play the French horn. I founded a jazz record label. I've sailed a sailboat across the Pacific. What have you done that isn't work-related? Why should people want to be around you? They were hard.